Hello there. Today is Tuesday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, students at a top Tehran university denounce Iran's leaders in a third day of protests.
The protesters return Sunday in response to calls on social media, chanting resign and death to liars.
The desperate situation for Australia's wildlife as bushfires continue to rage. Also ahead, Bob Marley's 75th birthday will be marked on the week of the music industry's biggest awards. It's all on today's International Edition. Iranians join protests on the streets of Tehran and other cities for a third day in a row. Sunday, following the Iranian government's admission it shot down a Ukrainian Airlines passenger jet Wednesday, killing all 176 people on board. The government had previously insisted that allegations of a missile strike were Western propaganda. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Iran's government is facing growing pressure from both abroad and at home, but it's not clear if the protests will develop into bigger anti-government demonstrations.
The protests began Saturday as mourners in Tehran turned their anger on Iran's rulers. The protesters returned Sunday in response to calls on social media, chanting resign and death to liars. Riot police were deployed in public squares across the capital. Videos posted on social media, which have not been independently verified by VOA, showed demonstrations spreading to the cities of Isfahan and Rasht. There appears to be widespread public anger at the government's initial attempt to deny responsibility for shooting down the plane. Zahra Razeghi is a resident of Tehran. She says, I can only say that the denial and covering up the truth over the past 3 days greatly added to the suffering and pain of the families. Saeed, also a resident of the capital, also voiced his anger. He said our media tried to describe the cause of the incident as a technical issue because of their interests and political reasons. But later developments changed the game and they had to tell the truth. Britain's ambassador was briefly arrested Saturday. He says he had been attending a vigil in memory of the crash victims, but left when the protests began. Pro-government protesters gathered outside the British embassy Sunday, demanding his expulsion, and the Iranian government summoned him Sunday for an explanation. Britain says his arrest was a violation of international law. US President Donald Trump tweeted support for the anti-government demonstrations and warned Tehran against what he called another massacre of peaceful protesters. Iran's Fars news agency said demonstrators had torn down posters of Qasem Soleimani, the general who was killed in a US drone strike over a week ago, triggering large anti-US protests. Iran responded to his death with missile strikes on two military bases used by American and Western forces in Iraq. Hours later, Iran accidentally shot down a Ukrainian Airlines jet just after it took off from Tehran's airport. The commander-in-chief of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, General Hossein Salami, spoke to lawmakers in Parliament Sunday. He said, we were at war with America, and we still are. We are soldiers of this nation and devotees of this people. I swear to Almighty God that I wished I were in that plane and had crashed with them and had burned, but had not witnessed this tragic incident. Iran's government appears to be lurching from one crisis to the next. First, the US killing of its top general, and then growing global condemnation over its handling of the plane missile strike. Now, Iran is facing growing pressure from its own people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron summoned the leaders of the Sahel G5 African nations to southern France Monday to discuss the ongoing efforts to counter Islamist militants in West Africa. The Sahel G5 are not just facing an expanding militant presence, but also climate change and a growing humanitarian crisis. Joining us from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. She's been following these efforts by France's leader to take on the militants. Catherine, what exactly was the goal of the meeting with the leaders? It sounds somewhat like Emmanuel Macron was giving them a bit of a dressing down.
That has been the perspective of these G5 countries. It had been thought that the French President Emmanuel Macron hadn't felt that he'd been getting enough support from the leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, Niger, and Mauritania for the French military operations in the Sahel region. So, and he made that very clear just before the summit started. President Macron, accompanied by these five leaders, went to a military base nearby the summit venue where they paid tribute to 7 of the 13 French soldiers who died on patrol, on mission in the Sahel in December. But in particular, what Emmanuel Macron wanted was he wanted to redefine that mission to try and halt spread of Islamic jihadism across the Sahel and to, again, have some sort of support from those countries.
My understanding is that he's concerned about, you know, civilians and the danger of this whole situation basically losing control.
Indeed, he is. I mean, he feels quite strongly that this, what we're talking about here, is the future for Africa. When you're not just talking about security across those G5 Sahel nations, you're also talking about security in Algeria and Libya. So what he has come up with, together with these five G5 leaders, is that there's going to be far more of an integrated military command. There's going to be a political, strategic, and operational command that's going to bring together the forces of the five Sahel countries as well as the French forces. So what they believe now is it will be far more effective because they will be able to exchange your intelligence information, they'll be able to better coordinate, and as far as Emmanuel Macron is concerned, they will be able to better define who is the enemy. And he made this very clear at the press conference afterwards. He said the enemy is the Islamic State and Greater Sahara, these militant groups that are linked to Al-Qaeda and linked in the Islamic State that have got a very strengthening foothold in that region. And the particular region he was talking about is this so-called three-border region, this region where Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger come together that really is causing so many problems when it comes to security in the region.
Did he get a response to his concerns?
He did. They came out with a joint declaration saying that, yes, they wanted France to stay, that they needed to have some sort of united front to show that there was going to be a movement against this increasing number of attacks, not just against the French forces, but against the G5 Sahel forces. So he did get that. The question, of course, is whether at this stage it will be enough to calm, particularly in Mali and Niger, Burkina Faso, this growing resentment against French that's considered that they are there for neo-colonialist reasons. Whether or not there will be the improvement in security in this region, particularly that three-border region, whether that security will come fast enough to be able to sort of, if you like, put to bed this idea that France is there for its own good when France is saying they're only there for to bring stability to the region and to allow the G5 Sahel nations to regain their sovereignty.
That is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. We appreciate your perspective. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russia and Turkey are determined to call the shots in Libya. U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr says 21 Saudi military members have been sent home after a U.S.-based shooting. Human Rights Watch says China's respect for human rights is on a downward trajectory. And Joker leads the Oscar nods with 11 as women were left out and snubbed. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. U.S. House of Representatives is expected to transmit the articles of impeachment to the Senate this week, setting up a trial to determine whether U.S. President Donald Trump should be removed from office. Speaking on the Senate floor on Monday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's delay gambit produced zero results.
Well, I'm glad the Speaker finally realized she never had any leverage in the first place to dictate Senate procedure to senators and is giving in to bipartisan pressure to move forward.
Well, also speaking on the House floor, Pelosi had withheld the articles in hopes of assurances there'd be a fair trial with witnesses. There's still no clear picture as to how the trial will look, whether it'll be fair. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the House floor as well, or a Senate floor, said Republicans just can't come up with a reason not to request more testimony at this impeachment trial.
Republicans are so unwilling to argue against witnesses, they can only support delaying the decision. Like a broken magic eight ball that keeps saying, ask again later.
Joining us to talk more about all of it is Claire Finkelstein, faculty director at the Center for Ethics and Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania's Law School. Thank you so much for being with us. So are we any closer to understanding what sort of trial this will be and how fair it will be?
We are not any closer to understanding if this will be a fair trial, but the question is whether Nancy Pelosi is. I think she knows that the Democrats made a mistake by not calling more witnesses in the House, and that's just a matter of tactics, though one understands why they did it. And now she understands how essential it is to have certain witnesses, like John Bolton, appear in the Senate if there is to be any hope of removing the president. I think that, my guess, that she was unable to strike a deal with Mitch McConnell. I think there are deals there to be made, but basically McConnell's hold on the Senate is too strong, and it seems very unlikely that they'll be able to call witnesses, which is the most essential aspect of the upcoming trial.
How can this be a trial without witnesses, and will it even be something that the American people will be satisfied with if that's the case?
I think the American people are largely supportive of removing the president, at least from the polls that have been taken. And at the very least, we know that the American people want to hear the witnesses. Mitch McConnell has indicated his intent to shut down the trial as quickly as possible. So the issue will be whether or not there are four Republicans who are willing to vote with the Democrats on having witnesses if the Democrats all vote lockstep in favor of those witnesses. Right now, it doesn't seem likely that they're going to have the four that they need, and it's also not clear that all the Democrats will vote in favor of witnesses. So Nancy Pelosi may have been trying to solidify those votes and doing the best that she could to try to ensure that even if she couldn't cut a deal in advance, that she'd be able to get witnesses in once the trial started.
The other interesting thing about an impeachment trial in the Senate is that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is overseeing it. I'm wondering how that plays out as far as how much ability he has to ensure it's a fair trial. What is his role?
Right. So what's really fascinating here is that this could be a constitutional crisis of the first order among three different branches of the federal government, not just two, as we're sometimes used to seeing, if indeed the Democrats can get the votes together to call witnesses. Because what could happen is that the Senate sends out subpoenas to call witnesses, and President Trump, as he's indicated, says that he's exerting executive privilege to bar them. That could very easily end up in the court and come before the Supreme Court very quickly. And then the question is, what would the Chief Justice do in such a case? Would he have to recuse himself from any court proceeding trying to make a decision about the scope of executive privilege? In my view, executive privilege is the big issue here, and it's hard to see that it wouldn't end up being on trial and ultimately in front of the Supreme Court if indeed witnesses were called, given how damaging that would be to the president.
How unprecedented would all of this be if this ended up in the Supreme Court? Have we ever seen anything like this?
The closest we've ever come to seeing a case like this is the decision in the Clinton trial where the Supreme Court had to say that a sitting president does have to respond to a subpoena in a civil case. But we have not really tested the limit of executive privilege as we need to. It's very important that the court be able to weigh in on this because, after all, the claim of executive privilege comes from an interpretation of Article 2. And Trump has said that Article 2 of the Constitution allows him to do anything he wants. Well, it's really important as the current impeachment trial may be, what's more important in the long run is that we have a judicial decision telling us what is the scope of Article 2 so we know, is a president allowed to do anything he wants or are there limits on what a president can do?
All right, that's Claire Finkelstein. She is the faculty director for the Center for Ethics and Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania's Law School. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans are still without power and water since last Tuesday's earthquake. That tremor killed one person, injured nine others, and damaged or destroyed hundreds of homes and several schools and businesses on the island's southwest region. There have been dozens of aftershocks as well, including a 6.0 quake on Saturday that caused further damage. More than 2,000 people remain in shelters, many of them fearful of returning to their homes and others unable because of extensive damage. AP correspondent Danica Cotto reports.
People in southwest Puerto Rico are terrified to go back home. A lot of them are spending time in government-run shelters or they're hauling mattresses outside to their porches. Others are setting up camp in public plazas. Many say that if they do have to enter their home, they're taking really quick showers, preparing coffee really quickly, and then leaving again. City officials say they're trying to find housing for those whose homes were damaged by the quake.
All right, that's AP correspondent Danica Cotto reporting. A grim summer of fire and smoke has sullied Australia's outdoorsy and healthy image and left many fearful for the future. Out-of-control bushfires in Australia have prompted an international outpouring and donations from around the world to help communities and animal populations. Australia's unique flora and fauna have taken a catastrophic hit, with an estimated 1 billion animals killed. The country's environment minister, Susan Ley, has warned that in some areas, koalas may have to be reclassified as endangered.
The community has really been struck by the images of koalas affected by these fires, and it's been quite heartbreaking. Scientists are estimating that maybe 30% of koala habitat has been lost here in northern New South Wales. We know that habitat's recently been lost on Kangaroo Island, so that we know that koalas have really taken a hit. It will be some time before we know exactly what that means for their numbers, but obviously koalas will be a big area of focus for us.
They also announced Monday that $50 million Australian dollars will be initially put aside for protecting wildlife and restoring habitat.
25 for our wildlife carers and hospitals, our zoos that are standing ready to do what they do best, breed insurance populations and get out there in the field and help.
Joining us to discuss this ongoing ecological disaster's impact on the country's wildlife populations is David Lindenmeyer, professor at the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University's College of Science. Thank you so much for being with us. You're currently in Melbourne to speak with the State Minister of Environment there in Victoria. Before we get to the actual wildlife destruction on the ground, tell us exactly what you'll be discussing in these meetings.
We'll be talking about recovery programs for threatened species, such as the greater glider, which is an amazing animal. It's like a small gliding koala, and it's highly threatened by fire, by logging, by extreme temperatures associated with climate change. So we're going to be developing some strategies to recover not only that species, but a whole range of other species that occurs with the greater glider.
The world is watching in horror at what is happening in Australia, and the numbers are beyond astounding. Is it accurate to say that there have been billions of animals lost in these fires?
That is accurate. The latest estimates that I've seen suggest that over a billion individual vertebrate animals have been lost. And this morning there was an analysis posted suggesting that perhaps up to 700 species of animals, including invertebrates, may be lost as a consequence of these fires. So this is truly unprecedented, and it changes everything. It changes the way we think about fires. It changes the way we think about other disturbances such as logging. It changes the way that we have to deal with climate change. This is the new normal, a comprehensive rethink of what's going on in the world and in Australia.
You wouldn't think of even the birds. You know, we've heard about cockatoos.
Yes, glossy black cockatoo on Kangaroo Island is under extreme threat, but there are others such as the northern bristlebird, and we know that the more fire that there is in the landscape, the less birds that we have, and that effect lasts decades and decades after fires, as we've found from our long-term monitoring. So not just on mammals, but on birds and on reptiles and invertebrates right across all the different groups of animal and plant.
You would think at least birds could fly away, but I guess not if it's that thick.
Yes, but also you have to remember that where do they fly to? They can fly to other places that are unburnt, but by and large, many of those places are already occupied by individuals of the same species or sometimes competitors from other species. Many of these animals actually have nowhere to go when their habitats are incinerated.
This has to be heartbreaking. And you're talking about things that are not recoverable for many, many, many years, decades. Is this not even close to over?
Oh, this is not even close to over because, by and large, in the state of Victoria, where I am at the moment, the actual peak of the fire season is still another 2, 3, 4 weeks away. That's when Victoria normally has its most severe fires. What's unprecedented here is how early these fires have started, but also how widespread they are. And perhaps even more importantly, is how frequent some of these major fires are. So we know that in East Gippsland, which is on the border between the state of New South Wales and Victoria, that some areas have now burnt 3 or 4 or even 5 times in the last 20 years. And those ecosystems are not supposed to deal with fire more than about once every 50 to 100 years. So there's a big change in what we call the fire regime, which has an enormous impact not only on individual animals, but even on the ability of an ecosystem to recover in its own right. So we really are in uncharted waters here.
It doesn't sound like this is an easy problem to solve.
The solution to these problems are at multiple levels. The most important thing in terms of fire and fire behaviour is climate and weather. And in Australia, in 2019, we had the hottest temperatures ever on record, on average, across the country. And we had the driest conditions on record across the country. The hotter conditions, drier conditions give us more extreme fire weather. So what that tells us is that we simply have to tackle the problems of climate change. So a really good illustrative example is an analysis which showed that temperatures of 40 degrees Celsius, 4 days on record, without climate change, would have occurred once every 16,000 years. Now what we see with current conditions, temperatures of 40 degrees on 4 successive days are more likely to occur every 1 in 6 years. So therein lies the fact that climate change is driving the kinds of weather that lead to these massive fires. So we have to do something at the global level to tackle climate change. But at the regional and landscape level, we need to be much more attentive to increasing the extent of protected areas to be able to ensure that some unburnt forest remains for those species to be able to survive. And we also need to recognise that some industries are over. We cannot keep logging forests when so much of the forest is already burnt. We need to move our wood production into plantations, which are much easier to protect, which don't have the other biodiversity values that are so important, and that we can get good crops of wood off them quite quickly so that they're less likely to burn. So there is a need for a comprehensive change to the way that we manage the landscape, that we manage our climate, and manage bushfire risks in Australia. Things have changed. They will never be the same again, and we have to make some sensible policy and management changes, and this is the time to do it.
All right, that's David Lindenmayer, professor at the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University's College of Science. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
Our voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Almost as significant as who has been officially nominated for the Oscars is who is not. AP correspondent Margie Sarzaletta takes a look at the snubs.
Congratulations to those men.
Actress Issa Rae made that comment after reading the Best Director nominees. There were no women. In acting categories, Jennifer Lopez, Robert De Niro, Eddie Murphy, Taron Egerton, Adam Sandler, and Awkwafina seemed like locks for nominations but got passed over.
Into the end.
Frozen 2 got a nomination for Best Original Song but not Best Animated Film. Beyoncé's song from The Lion King and Taylor Swift's song from Cats failed to get Best Original Song nominations. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
This is Science in a Minute.
In December, an online report on the Astronomer's Telegram website indicated the star Betelgeuse was decreasing in brightness. This set off headline-grabbing speculation that the variable red supergiant star was getting ready to explode into a spectacular supernova. Since then, a number of astronomers have refuted this assumption, with some saying it might go supernova in about 10 to 100,000 years from now. Astronomers at Louisiana State University, citing their research, recently suggested that a binary system called V Sagittae will explode when the two stars crash into and merge with each other around the year 2083. They say that this explosion will make it the most luminous star in the Milky Way galaxy. The binary system is currently described as being barely visible, even with mid-sized telescopes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Next month's Grammy Awards will honor the best of the music industry and will include a week-long celebration of the life and legacy of reggae icon Bob Marley. The events will mark Marley's 75th birthday in conjunction with the One Love Hotel in West Hollywood, a hotel renamed in the spirit of Marley's classic hit. The hotel will also host a pop-up shop featuring all things Bob Marley. The Marley family will be taking part in the festivities that honor his legacy in what is expected to be a year-long celebration with performances, exhibitions, fashion shows, and much more. Bob Marley would have turned 75 on February 6th. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News.